From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States is a deeply racialized country, no matter what pundits and commentators like to say. This nation was founded on genocide and slavery and has never reconciled with its ugly past. And so there's no surprise that the vestiges of that deep racial injustice continue to manifest today, even as we pay lip service to equality and freedom. How do parents, especially Black parents, raise their children in a society that teaches them they have the same rights as others, but that in practical terms, they will face more discrimination and more brutality? Addressing that difficult task in a deeply moving book is my guest, Imani Perry. She is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, the author of 6 books, including the award-winning Looking for Lorraine. She now joins me to discuss her newest book, Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. Welcome to the program, Imani.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me what led to you writing this book. Is this something that you've thought about before you became a parent, or something that sort of struck you that you needed to do after you became the mother of boys?
The concept was brought to me by my editor, Gayatri, who's phenomenal, in part because I talk so much about my sons and they're such an integral part of my work as a scholar, as a writer, as an intellectual. But that said, I've been writing letters to my sons from a very young age, and oftentimes about these sorts of questions, you know, what my hopes for them, my desire that they understand the world that they live in, and yet it not stymie their sense of possibility and their sense of dreaming. And so personal letters, conversations, and then Gayatri saying to me, you know, given how much you talk and write and think about parenting, and particularly in conversation with your sons, have you considered writing to them? And it just immediately struck me as absolutely something that made sense to do, that it was important as a Black woman and as a feminist for me to step into what is a beautiful tradition in African American letters, but which there aren't that many women in that tradition of the kind of intergenerational writing. And of course, they've come of age both in the context of the first Black president and having a white nationalist, white supremacist president and the era of Black Lives Matter. So there's something particular about this moment in history that made it, I think, prescient and feel urgent, frankly.
So the letter that you write that forms your book delves deep into history, brings that historical, as you said, intergenerational perspective to it. Because, of course, where we are today is the result of generations of work and all these opposing forces. What were some of the historical narratives that you felt were really critical for your children, for your sons to know about?
Sure. There's so many, but there's a very direct relationship between this book and W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk, and the way he tries to sort of capture history, give voice to the extraordinary resilience and creativity of Black people in the face of degradation and oppression and enslavement. And similarly, James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time and the essay A Letter to My Nephew, Toni Morrison's A Mercy and Song of Solomon, and Langston Hughes' poem Mother to Son. And in many ways, all of these are about understanding from whence your elders came with sensitivity, understanding that you have an inheritance from them that is quite extraordinary, figuring out how to create beauty and lives of meaning, notwithstanding the depth of racial inequality, and that you have a responsibility to follow in the tradition of being foot soldiers for the struggles for liberation for yourself, but also for others. And so there really is a kind of vast body of work that I think it's important to give my children, but there's also plenty of references that are not directly in that tradition. That is also a sign that I think we should take the resources wherever we find them in order to live well and do meaningful work.
I'm wondering if you can read a section from your book for our audience where, you know, we can get a taste of how you directly address them and bring in that history.
Sure. Sons, I know you have heard about the abolitionist Sojourner Truth. She has slipped out of the pocket frequently for Black History Month bona fides. Her story is sparely told, 1,000 times over each day in February. Lacking potency even more than accuracy, the tellers make her, as you well know, both melodramatic and frankly boring. The truth is better. In 1826, Truth, enslaved in New York, ran away from her captor. She was due to be freed by dint of the gradual emancipation statute. But she suspected her owner was trying to find ways to keep her, so she got free herself free. 2 years later, her son Peter, who was also due to be freed, was sold away to a plantation in Alabama in violation of the New York State statute. Truth, illiterate and Black, sued for Peter's return, and she won. I have imagined her testimony, imagined because we have no authentic record besides the fact that she always made listeners quake. The depth in her voice, the straightness of her spine, the ripple of terror and outrage. Her child was stolen. I imagine Peter, too, down south for the first time, facing rows of cotton. Maybe his fingers bled. Cotton is rough. Maybe he stood in a parallel row to one of our people, ones who had only had Alabama's cruelty. It could be that a grand of ours fashioned him a straw pallet, made it extra plump to soften his fate, fussed at him, boy, eat, when he couldn't stop crying and snotting, mumbling in Dutch, missing his mama. Long miserable nights before, like a miracle, he got to go north, back home. So many mothers, many thousands more, never saw their children return. They witnessed only departures, theft, except perhaps on some private Pentecost, days full of unexpected grace in dreams or in the afterlife, or all three. In the flesh, on the block, they trembled. Buyers admired the evenness of form, the power, the things I admire, your sinewy strength, the eyes that tend towards vigilance. Beautiful to me, valuable for human thieves. Mothers like me once had no recourse, no power to hold off the lash, to hold on indefinitely, to fight back when they crushed your heart and life. I think back then I would have been like Frederick Douglass's mother. I would have bared one of my scars like the one on my knee from a bit of flying charcoal at a cookout when I was 6, and told you to remember me by it, in the crowd of endless labor, to know me by it. And if I didn't have a landmark on my flesh, I would have made one for you, carved it into my right arm, a knifed X for your mother. So you know, this life we have is grace.
Imani Perry, my guest, reading from her new book, Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. This section that you just read, does this historical chapter really form the basis of the relationship between Black parents and children in today's America, that from the beginning, Black parents have tried to protect their children in this country from forces that have sought to exploit them and rip them away? We talk about family separation today. There's been family separation right from the start, right?
That's right. And it is one of the cruelest inheritances of being American. And I want to both say that it is... it's a feature that is particular to Black experience, but of course not exclusive to it. And we see that at the border now. And we see that in the history of Indigenous people as well. But there's also, I always want to simultaneously sort of give recognition to the kind of strategies that people who were subject to such violence and such theft in their lives and such destruction of intimacy found ways to sustain intimacy, to rebuild it, whether it was the processes of finding family again after emancipation or the ways in which we built extensive fictive kinship networks where people would build family even after loss that was not biological family but was no less significant. And so there's both this tradition of incredible cruelty, and we see it with prisons as well, right? And also this tradition of making a way that is meaningful, notwithstanding that. And I want to be very sure that my children and other young people understand the latter tradition, because the cruelty isn't ending, but we have to stay strong for the fight ahead of us.
There's another section in your book that I just want to quote, because I just thought it was so powerful, when you talk about how you find yourself holding back in front of your own sons. You say, I am charged with holding back the torrent of my rage. I do it for you. I betray you so that the full fury of white supremacy, with a currency of tears and accusations of insane black hypersensitive rage, doesn't come down on you. Let's tease that apart a little bit. If you were to just be frank and candid with your sons about the full force of white supremacy, it would likely terrify them, right? So you have to, as a mother, protect them, but at the same time, prepare them. And that is a really fine line.
Right. And I am actually quite thorough going in my account. I think there's many ways to parent effectively in the face of an unjust world. I have always erred on the side of being truthful. But in the context where I know that they are confronting racism and that I am confronting racism, I hold back, and they see me holding back. And oftentimes they know I'm holding back, because if I were to unleash how angry I am, the consequences for both me and them would be incredibly deleterious, right? So literally almost every day, there is a way in which we wind up restraining what is a very reasonable reaction. You know, it makes no sense why we should sort of passively accept the depth of injustice, and that, you know, each day there's something to be rageful about, and the decision to hold it back is, I describe it as a sin, because it feels like a capitulation to the injustice. But we're trying to navigate the world, you know, and that's the cost of trying to navigate the world.
And is your goal then for this book to lead your sons to a future where they can express that rage without feeling, you know, that they will then be penalized for just expressing it, or maybe not have reasons to rage at all?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, you know, it would be beautiful if we lived in a just society or a just world, right? I do think that witnessing, and in this way, I find very, as I feel as though I'm very directly in the tradition of Baldwin, to believe that there's an ethic and a demand around witnessing, and that that if readers can be moved and feel witnessed and witness the social realities that are presented in this book, and also the tradition, because one of the things I'm very clear about is it's not, we are people with problems, but we're not problem people, right? And that there's often a slippage between the two. I hope for some degree of transformation, or at the very least to be in a chorus of voices, of testimonies, of struggles that lead to transformation, right? Yeah, I've said frequently that hope is an ethical responsibility for parents. Frequently, I don't feel particularly hopeful, but I think that there's an imperative to drive hope, because we do want to make a world that is better, and that is sustainable, and that is here for our young people.
Did you write this book hoping that it would be a relatable book for Black parents in general, or did you try to stay personal because your story is illustrative to other Black parents?
My story, I think, is, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I've been saying that it centers Black families, but it's written for everyone. And even with that, you know, the desire is to be very particular in ways that open the door to resonance, right? So that my story is in many ways a unique story, and yet I think there are many moments in which this work resonates with others, the work of parenting, right, of love, right, resonates with others, whether it's because of being from the same cultural and ethnic and racial community, or a community that suffers from like patterns of, you know, of marginalization, of oppression, of exclusion, or simply by virtue, and this is, I think I've experienced this thus far, simply the work of mothering resonates so deeply, and some of the fears and some of the anxieties, they have a very particular valence, you know, for Black mothers. But even though that resonance that I've received so far does seem to be opening the door to some kind of witnessing from mothers who don't have to think about racial issues. So there's really, it is an invitation in a broad sense.
The news of yet another Black person, generally it tends to be Black men, being killed by police officers in the U.S. often, of course, triggers discussions in some sectors of how Black parents have to have the talk with their children. Is that part of what also informed your desire to write this letter to your sons?
Well, you know, the thing is, to a certain extent, but what was much more on my mind was that the talk is a moment, and what I'm thinking about is a lifetime, right? So the talk is a moment where there's an instruction about navigating a particular kind of encounter, but the encounters with racism are quotidian. They're small and large, but they really are all the time. And so this is about sort of navigating one's life as opposed to a very particular kind of encounter. The particular kind of encounter is terrorizing. So it shapes, you know, it has a, so I don't mean to diminish it, but I also think it's very important to understand that there are encounters that are not perceived by most people as necessarily fearful or potentially tragic in the large sense, but that have the potential to be tragic because, for example, if you are in school and you have a teacher who sees you as fundamentally inferior, right? Or you are in a neighborhood where people see you as fundamentally inferior, or you're in a workplace, that has a direct impact, not just on the prospects of your life, but you have to have the resources to withstand that and to fight against that conception, oftentimes happening in relationship to someone who has far more power than you. And so the talk is one moment, but when I'm trying to instruct my sons about how to navigate these realities, I'm talking about a disposition towards the world that is one that I think has to be deeply resourceful, has to be deeply self-regarding, and has to be driven by a love of oneself and one's people.
Can you give us any examples of moments where you've interacted with your own children and felt that this, you know, is something that that has happened to my children, to my sons, because they are Black boys in America, and this is why I need to be telling these stories of the history of the struggle and what's required to reach that place where they no longer have to face discrimination?
Sure. They're actually quite overt examples, which I think is important because often we talk about, you know, racism being subtle these days, but they're very overt examples where, you know, so for a child to say, "I don't like you because you're Black," right? Mm-hmm. And then having the child's parents respond, you know, as though, "How could that possibly be? We've never communicated a racist thought," right?
So a white child told this to your Black child.
Yeah. Yes, several Black children, right? And this is more than one incident. There's variations on this theme. And I think oftentimes what white parents don't realize is that they communicate ideas about race without words.
Right.
And how they respond to Black people and their willingness to engage, to interact, how they navigate neighborhoods, who they talk to, who they don't, messages that never have to use the words related to race.
And who's in their friend's circle, who's in their social circle, and where they live, where they send their kids to school even.
Right. And so frequently the response to these moments on the part of white adults is deep embarrassment, but not trying to work through the dynamic. So then the responsibility is borne by Black parents and adults in children's lives to assist them in making sense, not just of the incident, but actually what it doesn't precipitate. It doesn't lead to a transformation. So everybody says racism is bad, and then responds that moment was bad, but it doesn't often lead to a deep self-reflection or effort at transformation in the community after it happens. There's this desire to sweep things under the rug frequently. And so that's sort of one of the overt examples, but, people so often want to treat those moments as so exceptional when they really are symptomatic. And so they have a lifetime of after children learn not to be so overt with those statements, of still having to deal with those sentiments.
Finally, Imani, I'm wondering, in terms of how we navigate our political situation today, you referred earlier to the fact that, you know, we have this white supremacist commander-in-chief today that didn't start a chapter on racism, but sort of has expressed it out loud in a way that we haven't seen coming from presidents in recent years. Do you feel that the Trump presidency has clarified existing racism in this country and made it clear for young Black children, or actively made it worse, actively made the lives of your sons and other people's sons more dangerous?
Gosh, sort of both and. I mean, in the sense that, there's something quite horrific to witnessing the leader of the nation overtly embrace these ideologies and the world by and large, the society at least, accept it. Right. So that there's moments, there's a cycle of outrage, but it certainly is. There's a complicity that the nation has. And it's also the fact that he has solidly a third of the nation that sees him as a champion. So when my children walk into the world long after Trump is out of office, they have to understand that a third of the people around them see that idea or champion that kind of belief system. So there's a sense in which it's made worse, and because there's a brazenness and an encouragement of violence associated with it in this moment. But it's not new. I think what is perhaps, if not new, but newly unleashed, is a lack of shamefulness about having absolute hatred of people based upon race or immigration status or sexuality or et cetera. That there is, there's a sense that people are absolutely unashamed. They feel affirmed in believing that those are correct ways of seeing the world. And so this is going to be a lifelong situation that my children have to navigate long after Trump is as out of the presidency.
Well, Imani, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book. Really appreciate having you on.
So much. I appreciate it. Take good care.
You too. Imani Perry is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, the author of 6 books, including the award-winning Looking for Lorraine. We've been discussing her latest book, Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.